Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking on one of the most rigorously studied areas in all of human performance.
Cardiorespiratory fitness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're going to try and transform all that dense research, all those papers, into a really precise analytical blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
We're moving way beyond just general fitness advice.
Mm-hmm.
This is about structured protocol design.
And our mission today is very specific. We're designing really an evidence-based roadmap for, let's say, a 40-year-old who has a pretty substantial training budget.
10 hours a week.
A 10-hour weekly budget. And the goal is simple. Maximize VO Euro max gains.
But not just for, you know, a personal best in a 10K.
No, not at all. This is about the profound, the truly measurable impact this one metric has on your lifespan and, just as importantly, your health span.
So we've basically distilled every meta-analyses, randomized controlled trials, all the leading physiological models.
Everything from the Thick equation down to the real nuances of polarized training.
And we're treating this 10-hour budget like it's a high-value resource.
Mm-hmm.
So the core question is, how do we allocate those 600 minutes a week for the absolute highest return on investment?
And the stakes here, well, they really couldn't be higher. We have to establish right away why we're treating this with such, you know, analytical seriousness.
Okay.
VO max is not just a performance indicator. The research is crystal clear on this. It is statistically one of the strongest quantitative predictors of all-cause mortality.
Stronger than some of the things we normally think of.
Oh, much. It often outperforms traditional medical risk factors, mm-hmm. things like smoking history, blood pressure, even diabetes status, in predicting who lives longer and healthier.
So we're not just chasing watts on a bike or a faster pace on a run.
No.
We are designing a longevity intervention where the actual outcome is measured in years of functional, healthy life.
Exactly. And the most vital and I think counterintuitive insight that's going to guide our whole approach today is this. The path to maximal aerobic capacity is not achieved through constant grinding moderate suffering.
Right.
It's a very specific, highly polarized structure. Think 80% easy, 20% brutally hard.
And it actively avoids that middle ground.
It strategically avoids the tiring, low adaptation gray zone of moderate intensity. That gray zone, you can think of it as the economic black hole of endurance training.
And our protocol is designed to eliminate it.
Completely.
Okay, so before we can start designing this engine, we really need to understand the mechanics. What exactly are we optimizing when we talk about this maximal rate of oxygen consumption? What are the levers we actually pull with training?
Right. So VO's max, in simple terms, is just the maximum capacity of your entire system, your lungs, your heart, your blood, your muscles, to consume and utilize oxygen during maximal effort.
And it's usually expressed as?
Milliliters of oxygen consumed per kilogram of body mass per minute.
Mm.
And to really get how to train it, we go straight to the physiological definition, which is the Thick equation.
Okay, so VO euros equals cardiac output times the difference between arterial and venous oxygen content.
You got it. And that equation is like the analytical skeleton for this entire protocol.
So right there, you've got two fundamental components. You have the delivery system, and then you have the extraction system.
Precisely. Let's break down those levers. The first part, cardiac output, that's the volume of blood your heart pumps every minute, that represents the central delivery system.
The pump.
The pump, yeah. The engine. And we optimize this by pushing a few key things. First, stroke volume.
The amount of blood pumped with each beat.
Yep. And this is the single biggest determinant of peak VO max in trained people. Then you have blood volume itself. More blood means the heart can fill more, stretch more effectively.
And then heart actually changes shape, right?
It remodels. You get changes in heart size and ventricular capacity. You're building a bigger, more powerful pump. And this whole central system is extremely intensity dependent.
So this is the 20%?
This is pushed almost exclusively by that 20% of very high intensity work. It needs a maximal demand load.
Okay, so if that's the main highway in the pump, then the second part of the equation, that arterial minus venous oxygen difference, that has to be the utilization side.
That's correct. That's the peripheral utilization system. This is how efficiently your working muscles can actually pull the oxygen out of the blood and use it to make energy.
Like the local roads.
Think of your muscles as a vast city. You need infrastructure. You need power plants. And the gains here come from things like capillarization.
So building more tiny blood vessels.
Exactly. The local road network, so oxygen-rich blood, can get closer to every single muscle fiber. And then mitochondrial content and density.
More power plants.
More power plants inside the muscle cells to actually process the oxygen. And of course, increasing the efficiency of all the aerobic enzymes.
What's so fascinating here is the trade-off. If you just hammer the high-intensity stuff, you focus only on that central pump.
You end up with a huge pump delivering blood to a city that has, you know, terrible local roads and not enough power plants.
You've created a bottleneck.
A classic bottleneck. So maximal VO Euro max optimization requires training both levers, the central pump, and the peripheral infrastructure.
And the peripheral side is built by?
That's largely built through volume and duration. That's your 80% low intensity work. If you only train hard, your central engine will plateau because the muscles simply can't use the increased oxygen you're delivering. Our protocol has to coordinate both.
Let's get really quantitative on this longevity link. For the kind of person listening to this, we need to treat this data like it's gospel. Why is cardiorespiratory fitness such an overwhelmingly powerful predictor of all-cause mortality?
Because it quantifies the functional reserve of your body's most essential systems. I mean, look, when we talk about risk factors like high blood pressure, we're talking about a proxy for a cardiac strain. When we measure VO Euro max, we are measuring the result of systemic fitness and health. It's an independent predictor, which means its power to predict death holds true even when you adjust for everything else, age, sex, disease, you name it.
So give us the hard numbers. What makes this a highest stakes metric?
The quantitative risk reduction is just staggering. You can think about it in terms of MeetT, a metabolic equivalent of TASC, which is about 3.5 millifurigemin.
Right.
For every single one met increase in fitness, you lower your all-cause mortality risk by a proven 11 to 17%. That's across huge cohort studies.
Okay, let's put that in real terms for our 40-year-old. A 3-met improvement, which is achievable, going from, say, 40 to 50 millifurigemin, that could cut their long-term mortality risk by a third to a half.
That's the magnitude of the intervention we are designing here. But let's zoom out. One of the most compelling stories comes from that massive JAMA treadmill cohort study.
How many people were in that?
Around 122,000 patients. And it just showed the profound difference between fitness quartiles.
And what was the key takeaway from that enormous data set?
It showed this graded inverse relationship between fitness and mortality. So moving from the lowest fitness quartile to the highest, the elite level, was associated with up to a 5-fold difference in mortality risk.
A 5-fold difference.
To frame it vividly, the risk that comes with low fitness was comparable to, or in some cases even exceeded, the risk from established high-risk conditions like known coronary artery disease. Low fitness is a disease risk factor, maybe the most important one.
It's just an astonishing return on effort. Just escaping that bottom tier gives you huge rewards.
It absolutely does. The biggest marginal benefit comes from that first step, moving from the bottom quartile to even just below average. That step alone can cut your mortality risk by roughly 50%.
Okay, so for our protocol designer who wants to be elite, what's the analytical ceiling? Is there a point where more is not better or even harmful?
The data on elite cardiorespiratory fitness is overwhelmingly positive. Across all the big studies, elite fitness shows the absolute lowest mortality risk and, critically, with no upper harm threshold ever detected.
So there's no point of diminishing returns in terms of health?
Not that we've found. It doesn't mean infinite training is better, but it means the physiological adaptations that define an elite VO max, that high stroke volume, high capillary density, they're universally protective. So the long-term goal is to achieve and maintain a level of fitness that puts you in the top 5% for your age.
Okay, we can't manage what we don't measure. If our listener is going to implement a high-stakes protocol, they need high-fidelity feedback. What is the definitive benchmark, and then how do we practically track progress?
The gold standard is, and remains, the cardiopulmonary exercise test, the CPE.
In a lab.
In a lab, yeah. Typically to volitional exhaustion on a treadmill with direct gas analysis using a metabolic cart. This gives us the absolute number and, crucially, the analytical markers for setting our training zones.
So for someone who might only do that once a year, how do we know they actually gave a true maximal effort? What are the clinical criteria?
A true max test needs a couple of key things. First, you have to see a plateau in your oxygen consumption, a plateau in VO, even as the workload keeps increasing.
Okay.
And second, your respiratory exchange ratio, or RER, must be at or above about 1.1, 1.15.
And RERs.
The ratio of co-euros you produce to the o-euro you consume. Hitting that number confirms you've shifted overwhelmingly into anaerobic metabolism. You're truly at your limit.
Right, that's the baseline.
Yeah.
But since they're expensive, we need standardized field tests for more frequent tracking, say every 8 to 12 weeks.
Field tests are proxies, but they're excellent ones if you standardize them. For a runner, the Cooper 12-minute run is classic, or a 3K or 5K time trial is ideal.
Why those distances?
Because the pace you can hold for a 3K or 5K is a highly accurate proxy for your velocity at VO2 max, your VVO2 max. And we're going to use that to set the pace for our heart intervals.
What about team sport athletes?
For them, something like the yo-yo intermittent recovery test is often a better predictor because it includes that ability to recover from repeated bursts.
So the strategy is... use the field test result to set my specific training paces and heart rates, and then use my watch, my wearable, for tracking the trends.
Exactly. The field test is the analytical anchor. Your watch is, well, it's a noisy signal, but it's a useful one.
Okay.
Modern watches estimate VO max from submaximal heart rate and GPS data. The correlation is pretty strong, but the daily number can be thrown off by anything. Temperature, stress, a bad night's sleep.
So how should we treat that daily number?
Treat it as a four-week trend signal. Is the line going up? Is it stable? Is it going down? But even more importantly, track the convergent metrics that show real efficiency gains.
Like what?
Look at your resting heart rate, and look at your heart rate at a fixed, easy zone 2 pace. If you can run a 10-minute mile with 10 fewer beats per minute than you could 2 months ago, that is concrete, undeniable proof of improved cardiac efficiency, regardless of what the watch's VOS number says today.
That's the real sign of essential adaptation.
That's it.
All right, this is the core framework. Why is that seemingly productive, you know, moderate to hard effort, the gray zone, why is it actually detrimental to maximizing VO max? Why should we actively avoid it?
This is where training economy becomes so critical. Researchers have identified four main patterns of training intensity distribution, or TIB. The one that spends a lot of time in the gray zone, the threshold pattern, that's the economic failure.
So define that gray zone for us practically. Link it to those physiological thresholds we hear about.
Okay, so the low intensity zone, zones 1 and 2, is anything strictly below your first ventilatory threshold, or VT1. Practically, that's the pace where you can easily hold a full conversation.
Lactate production is balanced by clearance.
Perfectly. Then the high intensity zone, zones 4 and 5, is everything above your second ventilatory threshold, VT2, where conversation is impossible and metabolic acidosis just shoots up.
So the gray zone, zone 3, is that no man's land right between VT1 and VT2.
Exactly. And in that gray zone, you're generating significant metabolic stress and accumulating a lot of fatigue. Lactate production starts to outpace clearance. It demands systemic resources, elevates stress hormones like cortisol, and it really slows down your recovery.
But wait, I'm training hard there, so shouldn't I be getting a good stimulus? I feel like I'm pushing my endurance.
You are pushing, but you're creating disproportionate fatigue for the adaptation you get in return. That effort is hard enough to deplete your glycogen. It requires a lot of recovery. It elevates stress. But crucially,
it's not hard enough.
It is not hard enough to achieve that maximal central cardiac stimulus you need to really push stroke volume. You're not getting to that 90-95% of max heart rate. So you get all the fatigue costs of hard training without securing the maximal adaptations of either the central or the peripheral systems. It's the worst investment you can make with your 10 hours.
Let's turn this into a story of protocol efficacy. The Stugall and Sperlich randomized trial. This study really treated training distribution like an economic experiment.
It was a beautiful experiment. They took well-trained athletes, gave them all the same total training load over 9 weeks, but just distributed the intensity differently, and the results are this vivid cautionary tale against the gray zone.
What happened to the threshold group?
The threshold training group? The gray zone practitioners, they saw only a very modest 2% gain in their VO peak.
And the polarized group?
The polarized group, the ones who focused 80% on easy volume and 20% on maximum intensity, they saw an astonishing 11.7% gain in VO peak.
Wow.
Even the HIT heavy group did pretty well at about 4.8%. But the framework is just so clear. Polarization yielded roughly 6 times the adaptation of the threshold method.
So the pattern recognition here confirms the model. You get superior results because you strictly separate the physiological goals. The 80% volume builds the base, and the 20% pushes the ceiling.
You nailed it. You build the infrastructure, the peripherals in the easy zone, you recover quickly, and then you can hit the central pump brutally hard in the next session. The threshold trainer is just constantly too fatigued from those moderate efforts to ever really maximize the hard sessions.
Okay, so we've committed to the 20% hard work. Now we need the perfect design for those high-intensity sessions. HIED is the general term, but there's a huge difference between a 30-second all-out sprint and a 5-minute repeat. Which structure delivers that maximal central adaptation?
Right. And while all the reviews confirm HIED is superior to equal-time moderate training for VO vas max gains, the specific structure matters immensely for the maximal effect.
And the research seems to point to sustained aerobic efforts, not just peak pain.
Absolutely. The critical analytical parameter for VO max is time spent near VO vos max, or T at VO rho max. You have to sustain the effort long enough for the entire system, especially that central pump, to reach and operate at maximal oxygen uptake.
Which is best achieved with?
Intervals that are sustained, typically 3 to 8 minutes in duration, performed at about 90 to 100% of your VVO hero max.
Let's define VVO max practically again. How does our listener set that pace?
It's simply the velocity or power you hit at your maximal oxygen consumption. Practically, for running, your VVO max pace is basically the average pace you can hold during a really high quality, all out 3K to 5K time trial.
Okay, so if my 3K pace is 6 minutes per mile, that's my target.
That's your 100% VVO max target pace. For these 4 minute intervals, you'll be targeting 95 to 100% of that pace.
Let's bring in the classic evidence here, the Helgerud protocol. This study showed a massive adaptation response.
The Helgerud study is a cornerstone. They put trained adults through an 8-week protocol using that now famous 4x4-minute interval structure at 90 to 95% of max heart rate.
And the result?
A remarkable 7.2% improvement in VOUOs, and this is critical, accompanied by a 10% increase in stroke volume. The gain was driven by the heart remodeling. It just crushed the other groups.
But what about something even more brutal? If I'm looking for the most time-efficient and painful workout, shouldn't I be doing sprint interval training, SIT, like 30-second all-out bursts? That feels harder.
That's a great question, and it gets at a really common misconception. SIT, or those super maximal efforts, they're fantastic for anaerobic capacity, but they are inefficient for accumulating time at VO euros.
Why is that?
Because the effort is so short and intense, your central cardiac system, the pump, just doesn't have time to ramp up and sustain maximal oxygen uptake before you're forced to stop from muscular fatigue. For VO max development, which is an aerobic bottleneck, the longer sustained effort is superior. It forces the heart to maintain that maximal pumping rate for the full 4 minutes.
So for our goal, the length of the pain is more important than the peak intensity of the pain.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Our listener has committed to a substantial 10 hours per week. How does this volume integrate with the polarized model, and what realistic gains can a 40-year-old really expect?
10 hours a week is ample. It's a great budget for maximal gains. Research shows VO euros max gains are very volume responsive up to this range, and this budget allows us to hit that gold standard. 4 to 6 days a week of aerobic work, with 2 or 3 of those being designated hard days, it fits the 80-20 split perfectly.
And is a 40-year-old body still capable of adapting at a high rate?
Oh, absolutely. While the background decline rate for a sedentary person is about 10% per decade after age 25, the purpose of this protocol is twofold. First, short-term gains, and second, to dramatically slow that age-related slope.
And trained people can really bend that curve.
Trained individuals can often have that rate of decline.
So what are the immediate returns on a protocol like this?
If the listener is starting from a moderate baseline, which many 40-year-olds are, the expected gain is dramatic. We're talking a 15 to 30% improvement over 6 to 12 months.
And if they're already pretty fit?
Even if they're well-trained. Short-term block gains of 5 to 10% over an 8 to 12 week block are entirely realistic with this kind of optimized structure.
And progression has to be analytical.
It has to be. We progress by increasing the total time at VO max. That means moving from 4x4 minutes to 5x4, or keeping the reps but shortening the recovery. And we have to use block periodization.
3 weeks on, 1 week off.
3 weeks of loading, followed by a 4th week of deloading. That deload week is where the body actually consolidates the adaptations. It's like adaptation insurance.
Okay, theory becomes reality here. We're allocating the 10 hours, roughly 8 hours low intensity, 2 hours high intensity. Let's build the specific 7-day blueprint.
Remember, spacing is paramount. At least 48 hours between the two maximal central stimuli sessions.
Okay. Day one, VO Euro max intervals.
Yeah.
60 to 75 minutes. Mm-hmm. This is the primary session.
This is the non-negotiable central push. You warm up well, maybe 15 minutes easy, some dynamic stretches, a few short, sharp 30-second strides to get the heart rate up.
And the main set.
We progress it. Week one might be 4x4 minutes at 90 to 95% of max heart rate with a 3-minute easy jog recovery. These efforts should feel like an RPE of 8.5 to 9 out of 10. You should dread the last minute of every single repeat.
And then in week three, you progress to?
Maybe 4x5 minutes at the same intensity, or 5x4 minutes with a slightly shorter recovery. The total time spent near VO Euro max is the variable we're manipulating.
Day two, easy zone two endurance.
Yeah.
60 to 75 minutes. This is the peripheral builder.
And this is the crucial counterbalance. Heart rate has to stay strictly between 65 and 75% of max. Conversational pace. The goal here isn't cardiovascular stress, it's mitochondrial building. Do not let this drift into the gray zone.
Day three, high intensity intermittent work, 75 to 90 minutes, a different kind of hard.
Right, this provides more of a glycolytic and anaerobic stimulus, which is also effective for VO Air's max. Repeated sprint training, or RST, is great here. An example would be 3 sets of 10 repeats, 30 seconds fast, 30 seconds walking recovery.
And that 30 seconds is near all out.
RPE 9, yeah. And if you substitute a team sport here, like soccer or basketball, it needs to be a genuine high-intensity intermittent effort for at least an hour.
Day four, easy recovery, 45 to 60 minutes, active rest.
This should be non-impact, a bike, a rower, a swim. And the intensity must be minimal, zone one, RPE 3 or 4. This just promotes blood flow and clears lactate without adding any stress.
Day five, threshold or hard endurance, mm-hmm. 60 to 75 minutes, our strategic concession.
This is that 5 to 10% allocation we talked about. We include it sparingly because it helps raise the velocity you can sustain, which ultimately raises your VVO Air's ceiling.
And what's the structure?
You can rotate either 3x10 minutes at your lactate threshold or your 10K pace, or a continuous 20 to 25 minute tempo effort. This is an RPE of 7.5 to 8.
Okay, day six, the long zone two run.
Mm.
2 to 2.5 hours, the maximal peripheral stimulus.
This is the bedrock of that 80% volume, and it must be strictly zone two. This session is what maximizes fat oxidation and mitochondrial density. The little tip is maybe every other week you can push the last 20 minutes a bit harder up towards the top of zone two, but the core has to be sustained duration.
And finally, day seven, off or very easy with some mobility.
Adaptation happens during rest. This is non-negotiable. Take the day off or do a short walk and some dedicated mobility work. Mental and physical rest is essential.
Okay, modality matters for the absolute VO Euro max number. You mentioned running and skiing elicit higher values. For a 40-year-old, how do we balance that physiological hierarchy with the increased orthopedic risk from impact sports?
That is the classic trade-off analysis. Yeah, running uses more muscle mass, it's weight-bearing, so you'll typically get a 5 to 15% higher VO Euro max value than you would on a bike. Cross-country skiing is even higher.
But specializing in high-impact running carries a huge injury risk.
A significant risk, especially for a 40-year-old who's ramping up volume. And remember, the peripheral adaptations are local to the muscles you're using.
So what's the pragmatic, analytically optimal strategy for longevity?
You have to prioritize adherence over the absolute peak number. The strategy is smart cross-training.
So do the hard stuff on your feet.
Prioritize running or your high-impact sport for the key high-intensity sessions, your day one intervals. You need that modality specificity when you're pushing the ceiling.
And use other modalities for volume.
Use cycling or rowing extensively for recovery days and, crucially, for that long zone two session. This lets you accumulate that huge aerobic volume, the 80%, without the repetitive impact strain. You protect the joints.
That makes the 10-hour budget sustainable over years, not just weeks. Let's talk proactive defense, strength training.
It is absolutely non-negotiable, not just for power, but as injury prevention. 1 to 2 short, heavy strength sessions a week are perfectly compatible.
And we're talking big compound movements.
Heavy squats, deadlift variations, lunges, calf work. This improves your running economy, it reduces injury risk, and it mitigates that age-related muscle loss, which becomes the limiting factor later in life.
Okay, recovery isn't just passive, it's a measurable process. What are the key analytical frameworks for ensuring adaptation, not just accumulated stress?
First, as we said, spacing. Hard days need at least 48 hours between them. If you try to do them back to back, the quality of that second session just collapses.
And the physiological foundation.
Sleep.
Sleep is where the repair happens. You have to target 7.5 to 9 hours a night. Growth hormone, cortisol regulation, glycogen storage, it's all highly sleep sensitive. Without it, your ability to hit that required intensity on day one just vanishes. Now, the readiness gate. How do we use tracking metrics to decide whether to push through a tough day or downgrade the session?
We use three converging signals: resting heart rate variability, and subjective fatigue.
Okay.
If you wake up and your resting heart rate is elevated by more than, say, 5 to 7 beats above your weekly baseline, and your HRV is suppressed, and you just feel subjectively awful, the readiness gate is closed.
And the decision has to be ruthless.
Immediate and ruthless.
Yeah.
Downgrade the hard session. Turn the 4x4s into an easy zone 2 run. Pushing through those stress signals leads to non-functional overreaching, which actively reverses your gains.
Finally, let's revisit that deload protocol, the essential cyclical stress management.
Every 3 to 4 weeks, you have to do it. The protocol is precise. You reduce the high intensity volume by 30 to 50%, so you cut the reps or the duration, but you maintain the intensity on the reps you do.
Why is that so important?
It allows all that acute fatigue to dissipate so the central cardiac system can solidify the adaptation. If you skip the deload, you risk plateauing because chronic stress just masks your actual fitness improvements.
High intensity work relies on high octane fuel. What's the precise fueling strategy to ensure the quality of those 4x4 sessions stays maximal?
Those intervals are intensely glycolytic. They run on muscle glycogen. If you have low glycogen, you'll have low power output, and you simply can't spend enough time at your VO2 max.
So what are the carb demands for this kind of volume?
You have to load appropriately. On your moderate training days, you're looking at 5 to 7 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram of body weight.
And on the heavy days?
On the heavy days, like day 1 and day 6, that goes up to 7 to 10 grams per kilogram per day. It sounds aggressive, but it's mandatory to support that power output and ensure you recover.
And protein for recovery.
Critical. Target 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram per day and distribute it. We recommend a pulsing approach, 3 to 5 doses throughout the day. And crucially, get about 0.3 grams per kilogram of protein right before bed to maximize overnight muscle protein synthesis.
Let's get specific on the peri-workout timing for that hard day one session.
Okay, 2 to 3 hours out, have a carb-dominant meal that tops off your stores. Then if you need it, maybe a fast-digesting gel or drink about 30 to 60 minutes before you start.
What about during the sessions?
For the long zone 2 session on day 6, external fuel is necessary. Target 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour. If your gut is trained for it, you can push that towards 90 grams an hour with a mix of glucose and fructose.
And the immediate refueling window.
If you have another hard-ish session within 24 hours, rapid refueling is essential. Target about 1 to 1.2 grams of carbs per kilogram per hour, plus some protein within the first 2 or 3 hours post-session.
This protocol demands consistency. What is the analytical risk of taking time off? How quickly do these hard-won VO Euro max adaptations reverse?
The speed of detraining is the single greatest warning in endurance physiology. The adaptations are metabolically expensive, and the body dishes them quickly. The first thing to go is your plasma volume.
The fluid in your blood.
Right. It drops within days of stopping, and that immediately reduces your cardiac filling and therefore your stroke volume, the very thing you worked hardest to achieve.
So what does the data say? What's the damage assessment?
Short term, if you take a complete stop for just 2 or 3 weeks, your VO max will drop by about 4 to 7%.
So a 2-week vacation can erase an entire 8-week training block.
It can essentially erase the gains, yes. And long term, if you stop for more than 4 weeks, the decline averages around 9.4%, and you start seeing the peripheral system atrophy, capillaries, and mitochondrial enzymes start to disappear.
So if the 10-hour week becomes impossible because of life, what's the minimum effective dose to prevent that catastrophic regression?
The strategy shifts completely to intensity maintenance. You have to keep that central stimulus. If you're constrained to, say, 4 to 6 hours a week, the minimum dose is 2 high-intensity sessions per week. One of the 4x4 style, one tempo plus one longish Z2 session of 60 to 90 minutes.
And that can hold your fitness.
That maintenance dose has been shown to largely hold VO Euro's max for at least 15 weeks. It protects the pump.
Okay, once training and nutrition are dialed in, we look at supplements that provide evidence-based marginal gains. We're looking for those 1% to 3% bumps.
Exactly. We're stacking marginal gains that enhance the quality of the hard work.
Let's start with beta-alanine, which
Yeah.
is perfect for efforts in that 1 to 10-minute range.
Beta-alanine. The mechanism is it's a precursor to muscle carnosine, which buffers the hydrogen ions that cause that burning sensation and fatigue. So it directly helps you delay fatigue during those 4 to 5 minute intervals.
And the effect.
About a 2 to 3% performance improvement. The protocol requires daily loading, 3.2 to 6.4 grams a day for at least 4 weeks to saturate the muscles.
Next up, caffeine.
Caffeine. The mechanism here is it reduces your perceived exertion, your RPE. If you feel less tired, you can push harder. It can also acutely increase VO max by about 1.2% in a test setting.
So a reliable 2 to 3% bump.
Yes. The protocol is a precise dose, 3 milligrams per kilogram of body mass, taken about 45 to 60 minutes before your key hard session. Just be careful with sleep.
Dietary nitrates like beetroot juice.
Nitrates. They convert to nitric oxide, which is a vasodilator, and reduces the oxygen cost of submaximal exercise. So you run faster at the same oxygen uptake.
So the effect is improved efficiency.
Right. Small direct VO max effect, but a significant improvement in time to exhaustion. The protocol is about 6 to 8 millimoles of nitrate 2 to 3 hours before the key session.
Finally, creatine. Essential even for an endurance athlete.
Creatine, yes. It enhances rapid ATP resynthesis, which is crucial for improving the quality and power maintenance across your repeated hard sets.
So it's an indirect benefit.
It indirectly supports VO marrows by making sure your last 4 minute repeat is almost as powerful as your first. The protocol is just a standard maintenance dose of 3 to 5 grams a day.
We've designed a protocol for a 40-year-old. Looking out over the next few decades, what's the strategic shift we need to integrate now to maximize functional capacity well into our later years?
The focus has to evolve from just pure aerobic peak maximization to maintaining the fitness floor and proactively defending against the inevitable decline of muscle power.
So what does that maintenance floor look like year-round?
It's essentially that detraining mitigation strategy we talk about. You maintain a minimum of one dedicated VO max session, one tempo session, and one long Z2 session every single week. Then you use targeted 8 to 12 week full load blocks, maybe 1 to 3 times a year, to push the ceiling higher.
And you mentioned the shift towards power and strength.
That's the other critical shift. From 40 onward, the decline in muscle power often accelerates faster than the decline in VO max. Functional independence, climbing stairs, lifting groceries, catching yourself from a fall, that's determined by power and muscle mass.
So we can't specialize so heavily in endurance that we neglect the weight room?
No. Integrating heavy strength training 1 to 2 times a week becomes an increasingly important longevity strategy. It's about maximizing the capacity of the entire motor system. We have to accept that we might sacrifice 2 to 5% of our theoretical peak VO max for the sake of long-term adherence and health.
It's about the high floor, not the fleeting peak.
Exactly.
We've executed the plan.
Yeah.
Now, how does our protocol designer analytically verify that adaptation is occurring exactly as we want? What's the systematic testing schedule?
The cadence has to be fixed. You retest your standardized field test, that 3K or 5K time trial, every 8 to 12 weeks. And this isn't for vanity. It's an analytical requirement.
Why adjust?
Because if you gain 5% in fitness, your old 4x4 pace is no longer 95% of your max. It might only be 90%. If you don't increase the pace, you fall back into the gray zone and adaptation stalls. The retest recalibrates your pace targets.
And beyond the retest, what are the key metrics to track weekly?
We track three things. One, your VVO max, or your 3K to 5K pace. That's the output measure. Two, your heart rate at a fixed zone two pace. That's your measure of cardiac efficiency. If your heart rate drops at the same easy pace, that is direct proof of stroke volume improvement.
And the third.
RPE for the standardized interval sessions. If you can hit the same pace, but your average RPE for the session drops, your system is adapting. If the RPE is climbing, you're failing to recover and you need a deload.
So the ultimate analytical takeaway is we're looking for that converging evidence, high adherence, central efficiency gains, and maintained session quality.
Absolutely. The success of this protocol is measured not by speed alone, but by that pattern. Consistent application of the polarized split, increasing power at the same RPE, and measurable physiological efficiency. That pattern is the blueprint for longevity.
This has been an incredibly rigorous deep dive, moving from, you know, the cellular mechanics of the Fick equation all the way to a day-by-day training prescription. Let's summarize the three highest ROI levers for our listener.
The three highest ROI levers based on the framework we built are: 1, strict adherence to polarized intensity distribution 80-20, avoid the middle. 2, implementation of aerobic HIIT intervals, specifically that 4 to 5 minute sustained effort. And 3, aggressive detraining and injury prevention.
And the promised payoff for implementing this analytical system.
For you, the listener, the expected gain is significant. A VO Euro max improvement of 15 to 30% over 6 to 12 months from a moderate baseline, leading to dramatically reduced all-cause mortality risk and robust preserved functional independence.
Fantastic. Now for our final provocative thought. We highlighted that some modalities, like cross-country skiing, can elicit slightly higher absolute VO2 max values than running.
Yes, due to total muscle engagement. Running is high, skiing is often marginally higher.
So if the listener is a true protocol designer, chasing that theoretical absolute peak number, they might be tempted to switch their main stimulus from running to, say, year-round ski erg training. Is that marginal 1% to 3% gain worth the massive complexity and specialized equipment?
The analytical conclusion, based on long-term adherence and risk management for a 40-year-old, is no. The functional gains of running are robust, but the orthopedic cost of specializing solely in one maximal modality is too high long-term. The optimal solution is not achieving the absolute theoretical peak for 1 year.
Excellent.
It's maximizing adherence and reducing injury risk via mixed modality training, which guarantees a high fitness floor for the next 3 decades.
Pragmatism winning over the pursuit of the absolute theoretical maximum. A solid analytical conclusion. Something to chew on as you implement your new 10-hour polarized plan.